and you to filter in. My name's Eileen Brown. I'm a reporter at The Intercept, where I cover environmental justice issues. And I wanted to set up this panel because at The Intercept this year, we published jails, prisons, and detention centers against indicators of the climate risk or climate crisis. So heat risk, wildfire risk, and flood. A lot of other people's projects, in particular, projects by my two co-panelists today. Land Grab Universities in 2020 project was really kind of an inspiration in a lot of ways. They identified the indigenous caretakers and inhabitants of 11 million acres of land that were stolen from people and redistributed as seed money for land grant universities. So Tristan's going to talk a little bit about that. Layla Yunus is here from ProPublica to talk about their Sacrifice Zones project, which came out kind of as we were finishing up Climate and Punishment, and was one of those things where they published, and I was like, oh, it's so good. I don't know if ours is going to. And 1,000 toxic hotspots across the country. So each of us are going to talk a little bit about our project, how other reporters can use. And Tristan is going to get us started.
Okay, it works. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the land grant university system, you'll likely know them as your state schools, so like Arizona State or Texas A&M, a couple of private universities like Cornell or MIT. Generally every state has a land grant university, at least land grant universities, but our project really focused on the sort of the institutions that were created through the Morrill Act of 1862. And for those of you who aren't, it was legislation to fledgling land grant universities, so those lands could be sold for seed money for those schools. Common around land grant universities is that the Morrill Act gave the gift of free land. But through our investigation, we found that the Morrill Act worked actually by turning land expropriated from tribal nations into seed money for higher education from more than 250 tribal nations for the benefit of 52 colleges. So this is, there we go. So how the act worked is that Congress had to have land to give. And again, this is sort of the crucial step in the reporting, is that the federal government had to acquire land from indigenous people. That land could range from less than an acre to more than 800 acres. And the lower image that you're seeing here is kind of what you see when you're looking out the window of an airplane. But each one of those squares is typically what one of those parcels look like. So, you know, when y'all are flying home this weekend, you can look out the window and you can see the footprint of colonialism on indigenous land really clearly. So images, basically how the act worked was that universities in the East, which had no more public land, were given coupons essentially for land in the West called scrip, and land from within their borders as they were established. In a moment. But here you can kind of see a look at that process, looking at two universities. So you've got University of California and Cornell University. As you can, as I mentioned, Eastern schools like Cornell here got scrap access. That's why there's so many connections across lands in the West and California. I think an important note to recall here is that many states in the West did not exist at the time the Morrill Act was signed into law and opened this land for sale so that universities could claim it and sell it to fund their endowments. So at the end of the Apache War, most likely everyone in here has heard of Geronimo. So at the end of the Apache War, forming the state of Arizona. So there's no treaty, there's no negotiation, it was outright conflict and war. I would technically call And also important to remember that Arizona did not become a state until 1912. So this is fairly recent history. I'll also note that combat with indigenous peoples lasted until the 1920s in Arizona. So 150,000 acres of this land, and much of which is still in their possession. When you look in Arizona, what it looks like on the ground, and as I showed earlier, sort of those parcels you can see from the skies, here's how we sort of broke it down. So this is in Tucson, 1886. And after statehood, selected and sold for University of Arizona. When you satellite view it, you can see there in the middle, you can actually see everything that's kind of built in that area. And when you get actually on the ground, where that red dot is, you can kind of see what's there. And you'll, in the picture, it's the Apache Tears Motel, which is kind of rude, but the picture was taken by our photographer, Kaylin Goodluck, who went out and actually visited a lot of these parcels so we could actually see what was there. At its highest point here, there we go. So the project is really about finding all of these pieces. Blaine's, the project is really to unwind the entire moral act knot, not to just really like identify the parcels that benefit one university, but all of the parcels that benefited all the universities. So the map that you see here is really that kind of idea in its most condensed form. So again, that's that violence-backed treaties, 250 impacted indigenous nations, and land that went to 52 universities. So those purple there is where the land is, red are where the universities are, and you can also see program. One of the things that we wanted to do with this project was make our data available to anybody who wanted to check our findings, do additional reporting and research, really make this an open source investigation. So if you're not comfortable using spreadsheets or you're not a heavy data user, we wanted to make sure that you could still have access to this information. You have a clear and user-friendly way. So here on the website, landgrabu.org, you have access to the same data that we were working with the same level of accuracy, and you can explore all of it through NELS. It gives you a lot of information. So this page, student enroller, like Cornell's, it gives you a lot of information. It gives you founding date, student enrollment. As you can see, what it allows you to do is see the connections between the institution and the fly through, or you can even locate if you live next to one of these parcels or even on one of these parcels, which our developer, Jeff McGee, found out during the reporting process. You have the opportunity to check addresses. So the search function there at the bottom right of the screen allows, in the case of Cornell here, as you can see, it's like a truly massive footprint that the institution has across the country, and really gives you an endless array of information to sort through. Date boundaries, the university links, or even indigenous land sessions. And obviously that information on land sessions is invaluable for a number of applications outside of this project. So for instance, your newsroom wants to put together a land acknowledgement. It's a really good place to start and take a look and see just where, what land session your newsroom is in. If you want to explore more, so we'll look at University of California here. You can get this mile high view. As you've seen before, and zoom in. So if you zoom into Los Angeles, you know, you can kind of take a look at sort of that raw data, those raw parcels there, and be able to click on those parcels. And essentially what the team has done is created more than 80 amount of detail, acre by acre and state by state. So when you zoom in here on this, and you can see just a lot of sort of like metadata, basically, you know, treaty cosigners, when it was acquired by the U.S., the gains associated with it. You know, just with this page, you can really start to construct a story about this particular piece of land. But also because our photographer, Kaylin Goodluck, was going out and doing this. So this particular parcel that just looks like metadata. So those tribes signed a treaty with the U.S., ceding their land in exchange. So in the end, the tribes got nothing, and the University of California raised $788.74 off the sale of this land. This process and actually going there was how we figured out that the Fort Lawton Post Cemetery in Seattle, Washington was once Duwamish and Suquamish Carolina University, South Carolina State. Despite negotiating this treaty with the federal government, the Duwamish are still an unrecognized tribe in Washington State. This land was sold for approximately $4, and those universities raised $58 from its sale at that time. And then finally, it also sort of helped us figure this land was obtained at the end of the Dakota War, which was marked by the hanging of Dakota men at Mankato. So for those of you who aren't familiar, just mass execution in U.S. history in which 38 Dakota men were hanged for their participation in the Dakota War. And 5 weeks later, the government of Minnesota, and this particular parcel sold for $1,000. And it's now a scrapyard. Institution still. I mentioned at the beginning that at least 16 land grant acres of land. And those acres brought in at least $8.7 million in revenue combined in fiscal year 2019 alone. I say at least that many schools, but we're working on some follow-ups around that, but they don't know where they got their land. They've got it. They just don't know where it came from. $1 million in fiscal year 2019 from a remaining 28,000 surface and extractive industries to continue to bring money into the university off of those land. Finances from fiscal year 2019 during the reporting of this story. So we don't actually know how much universities have made off of these lands since they were obtained. So that cumulative sort of number is completely unknown. And you can report it if you like. You can see here that we've got our GitHub, the work that we've been doing with it. Really easy user guide here, sort of plain language on what each file is doing, what you need it for, etc. There's a lot more information in here that you can download and play with in some of those with there. But again, this is the raw data, and we walk you through how you can build it out on your own, which we've seen a lot of newsrooms do, like Ion Ohio in Ohio, obviously has done some really great work around downloading this and looking at University of Ohio or Ohio State and all the parcels associated with that university. A lot of other places have really done some interest for more funding at their universities, as well as free tuition for Native students, actual land returns, a lot of interesting things that we didn't really expect in putting this story together that's come out by the project.
Thank you so much, Tristan. Layla?
That was really awesome. Maybe if I just present? Or actually, that did not do it. Yeah, okay. Let's do that. Yeah, why not? Try that. Okay. Representing a big team of reporters that worked on this project. Thank you so much for having me, Aline, and for inviting me to this panel. And the two people right here's projects were like to echo what you said, just really inspiring for me. So the project I'm going to talk about today is plants, where the idea for the latest project actually came from. Somebody on that team is actually in the audience, Mark Schlefstein. So we partnered with the Times-Picayune and the Advocate of New Orleans in 2019 on an investigation into Cancer Alley, which is this stretch of land on the lower Mississippi River that's famous for the concentration of chemical plants there. And that's what it looks like, sort of from Baton Rouge down to New Orleans, that stretch of land. And here are the chemical plants. You can see those black dots. And when we set out to work on this project, there was quite a bit of buzz around Cancer Alley. The Guardian had dispatched a reporter to the area, and there had sort of been a lot of stories because there was, actually, I'm going to remove this, ground in Cancer Alley. And so one of the questions that we sort of had was whether or not the new build out was akin to, also industry seemed to kind of treat this Cancer Alley as this open question, you know, like, is it, you know, than other parts of the state? And what they basically used to argue that point was this. It's a database of tumor data from the state of Louisiana. And what the rates and why they were able to sort of use this database over and over again to sort of point to this idea that cancer rates in Cancer Alley aggregated on the level of the census tract. This is actually better than a lot of other states. A lot of other states, tumor data only exists at the level of the county. I'm from central Louisiana, I get them confused a lot. The actual levels of toxic air pollution can vary widely. And so what I kind of discovered throughout this project was that sometimes the laws that are put in place to qualities. And so what my colleague Al Shaw and I decided that we really wanted to do in order to bring something new to the table that hadn't sort of been touched upon in all the reporting on Cancer Alley, we wanted to drill down and try to find what pollution looked like at facility fence lines. We actually map inequality in Cancer Alley because those of you familiar with the area know Cancer Alley, many parts of it are predominantly Black, and the places that are most affected by this pollution tend to be predominantly Black communities. The model is called the Risk Screening Environmental Indicators Model. And once we started looking into it, we were really impressed by its potential power. The reason for that is back to this idea of granularity. So RISI is this model that takes in information, weather data, topography information, where are they? And it spits out these estimates at these really small chunks of land that are 810 meters wide. To give you an idea of how wide that is, it's less than a kilometer wide. And you can actually see, like, you know, this is one grid cell and, you know, you can actually see sort of the neighborhood. So what you have here is, of course, a model. So it's not, you know, actual air samples, but it's a best guess what pollution looks like at the level of a facility fence line in the neighborhood, you know, right by the plant, in the elementary school or at the home really close by. So when we, so this is kind of, we overlaid the facility points on top of the RISI data. Just to kind of lot, you'll actually see the grid cells themselves. It's quite zoomed out. And these are where the build-out was happening. So one of our major... So back to this idea of how can we actually, you know, get close to this question of inequality. I want to also just highlight a couple other things that we did. So, for example, kind of like a lot of argument from industry that two different chemical plants are being developed. So what we decided to do after we published this story was we got a lot of emails from readers around the country who asked us, well, can you map my town? Can you map my neighborhood? And maybe then also we could do a nationwide analysis, a race-based analysis to try to understand the disparities on a way larger scale. That ended up being extremely difficult, you know, like South Louisiana, type of RISI data at the nation level, just to give you a computer shutdown. So I was like, okay, that's not gonna work. So we kind of had to, and we also decided that, you know, unlike the Louisiana project, we needed to actually try to get at this idea of chronic risk. People inhaling, you know, over a presumed lifetime of 70 years, right? That's sort of the has kind of a way of getting at, or a way of at least smoothing the information. It's like a data analysis term, right? So that we're not just maybe showing a facility that has a really bad year or a facility that has a really good year. We're kind of smoothing it out over time. So after much pain and also the help of a Google supercomputer, we arrived at this. So as you can kind of see here, we ultimately identified over 1,000 contiguous grid cells and grouped them into these hotspot formations that you see right here. And our map itself, which I'm sorry that I didn't pull up before. Can I exit and like look for? Okay. Here we go. So it's this thing right here. And I want to just show it to you. Actually published the principal data files of our analysis. You can go to our website and download them on our data store. And you can also use this map itself for reporting purposes. A lot of local reporters have reached is either search for an address or just click anywhere in a hotspot. And all the information is in this sidebar that pops up right here. So we show you the estimated lifetime cancer risk over the 5-year period of our analysis in that. Importantly, we show you the risk over time. So if you're covering an area, you want to make sure that it's not actually a facility and chemical breakdowns at each place, which you can also get to by kind of clicking up here. We give you basic information on the hotspot, like the number of people who live there. So after we identified all these hotspots, the question that remained was, how can we understand, you know, I assumed that the pollution on our map was segregated, but I wanted to prove it. And so I did that by the beauty of RISI data is that even though it exists in these little grid cells, which the massive data files, right, 120 gigs, you can do is obviously join it on census data and try to understand that. And I'm not going to call these findings surprising. Found these same disparities, but it is very striking still and really unfortunate that predominantly Black census tracts experience, according to our analysis, an estimated cancer risk that is more than double that of majority white. The tips that I have for map, paying attention to current and historical zoning laws is a really big one. In South Louisiana, for example, there is the legal designation even has its own local zoning board and can make critical decisions regarding the health of its future. So what I'm really referring to is I'm not able to kind of decide who gets to dump in their air and their water. So I would always pay attention to that when reporting on environmental justice issues. And the other thing, just to underscore one more time, is really about data granularity. I think, or county or whatever, sometimes that is the level of data that the government is going to offer you, but it's not always a level of data that is going to visualize or make evident the inequality. And so sometimes you really do have to figure out a way to dig deeper. We were lucky that we found a data set that actually had, you know, really granular information. I think if we hadn't found that data set, we would have had to have been creative and found a different way to go about it. Doing something more manual, maybe door knocking, trying to understand that's not there. Anything at the county level or at the census tract level, that doesn't mean that it's not there. And so my best advice that I could impart, this project really taught me, was that it's really helpful to see how much deeper and closer you can get.
Thank you so much, Layla. That was great. Okay. So I'm going to tell you all a little bit more about our climate and punishment project at The Intercept. So like I mentioned, we set out to map the locations of, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the findings that we came out of it with. You know, so we were able to identify some national trends. We found that more than a third of the detention facilities in the U.S. are located in counties that have historically had more than 50 days conditioned. A lot of the people in the facilities have health conditions that make them sensitive to heat. The federal institution today is located in a county with more than 50 days a year at a heat index of 105 degrees. However, by 2100, almost 700 facilities will be at that level. We were able to point to a number of state level trends located or are above the 90. So a lot of facilities in Florida have really high wildfire risk, and that's only gonna get worse. We were also able to deepen the stories of incarcerated people and their families that we were hearing. So, you know, for example, we'd heard that the Sierra Conservation Center, which is a prison in California, people there had had some really serious issues with smoke inhalation last fall. They also had a generator failure, so because of a wildfire, so they were out without lights for a month or two, and air conditioning, and you know, go figure, it's a facility that's at the 99th percentile for wildfire risk in the nation. So the data kind of showed that some of this stuff is predictable. You know, we also showed that Cross City Corrections Institution, which flooded this summer, was at severe risk of flooding. We found that a lot of facilities that had records of flooding were actually, if your facility is falling apart, if your roof is leaking, a big storm comes, you are going to have flooding. So if your state has a backlog of prison infrastructure needs, then you know, that might tell you something about the kinds of climate risks it faces. Thank you. So I'm going to provide some more examples of how to use our data to tell more stories later on, but I will tell you a little bit more about what it took to put this together. So, you know, we had the idea for the project before we had a data source. Felt like we were doing, you know, in my work, I really, the most vulnerable people and people who are incarcerated seemed like an obvious place to look for these kinds of stories. You know, people who are incarcerated are totally at the mercy of the state for their health and safety. A lot of people, when they're trying to cope with climate issues, move somewhere. You know, they go to another room, they like take a walk, they leave the city, leave the state. People who are incarcerated cannot do that. So we were doing a lot of one-off stories about these impacts as disasters were happening out. So it was really important that we reached out to people early on who were already looking at mapping incarceration and climate risks. So, you know, I had conversations very early with folks at Prison Legal News who had done some work mapping prisons against toxic sites. I also spoke with this activist organization, Fight Toxic Prisons, and paying hurricanes especially, but other kinds of disasters too, and paying attention to who's evac at UCLA. And he had been working with this, so it's a list of prisons, jails, detention centers that includes building footprints and location data that we really needed. Kind of indicators of climate-related problems. For heat, we eventually landed on the data set from the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is really great. It's their killer heat data. So we focused on 90 and 105, looking toward mid-century and looking toward the end of the century. And they looked at three different emission scenarios, you know, no action on climate, slow action, kind of Paris-level action. So that was also really valuable. And finally, they had actually used this data to look at look at military bases. And so they really had kind of proved that what we wanted to do could be done. We just switched in prisons for military bases. And so, you know, we have more resources than a lot of newsrooms at The Intercept, but we're still like a relatively small team. And so for us, it was really important to like Dahl, who's there, was enthusiastic to like hand us the data. This had been encouraged by congressional legislation, touch with the contractor that put the data set together, PyroLogic, how to make this work. And finally, for floods, we relied on data from the First Street Foundation. They have this flood factor, wider range system. We chose that because it takes into account a wider range of factors than FEMA's flood maps. And also, you know, we'd heard FEMA's flood maps could be difficult to work with. The First Street Foundation, they too agreed to work closely with us and help us combine these data sets. Senior research engineer, Akil Harris, who is my partner on this project from the very beginning, and there's just no way I could have done it without working closely with Akil. So he was doing the kind of nitty-gritty, like creating the map, making the data come together, and making sure our spreadsheet made sense, that you you don't need to like really get your head and hands into the material. So, you know, I was on the calls with all our data partners, and definitely don't be scared to ask lots of dumb questions. I did some of the analysis to figure out, the data trends that we wanted at tables, and that just involved like Akhil sending me, online day and, worth the time. Let's see what else. Yeah. So the other thing that running into all kinds of like surprises in the data and limitations that we had to figure out how to account for. You just need the time for that. And as you're spending time with the data and developing, the other thing that took a lot of time was actually reporting out the stories. So, you know, we're focusing on or want to talk to you. So it really took like weeks and months of developing relationships with people and it also kind of spoke to the issue of like needing some, you know, again, we were doing these one-off stories as disasters hit. And a lot of times if people are being evacuated, they don't have access to phones. There's just all kinds of issues that are happening as a crisis is striking one of these facilities. And so it was really valuable to be able to take a little bit more time and go beyond the kind of like news peg story. It'd be cool, although I do think it's cool. It came from thinking about our audience. I think Tristan spoke to this a little bit. We describe trends and case studies and the time to wrap their heads around a spreadsheet could work with. And so when you're talking about incarceration, everyone inside is struggling at fighting for their loved ones. So we wanted this to be something where search a facility and figure out what it might be confronting. And so like communities could also search for what kinds of facilities were in their neighborhood. To make the map happen, we had a number of people working on this. You know, we had a product developer, Fei Liu. We had a couple of software engineers. We had a design team and of course a great editor holding pieces together, Ali Grebe. Be meaningful for smaller newsrooms if you're looking to do a project like this. In terms of like finding stories in this data, I don't have it pulled up here, but I would encourage people to, pull some of these heat projections and various emission scenarios. So if you're in a particular community and looking at how the climate crisis is going to impact jails and prisons in your story, you can go in there, you can search a facility or all the facilities in your community and see how many days annually they're reaching dangerous heat thresholds and how that's going to change in the next 100 years. And so that kind of tells a story about the urgency of making some choices about what's useful for finding stories. So say you are a reporter in Missouri. Risk and look up Missouri. You can click through heat risk, wildfire risk, flood risk, and you can look on the side here. You know, not only can you see what kinds of carceral institutions are in your community, something that's not always easy to determine. You can also like look on the side and see these facilities ranked in terms of the various risk flood risk facilities in Missouri. You can see some details about the facility, what kind of heat risk it faces, flood risk. The Department of Homeland Security, they posted it in 2020, and they did not want to share as many details as we would have liked about their methodology. So we're really relying on DHS here, and we included the kind of status that they had in their big spreadsheet. So if you saw that this facility has, county or state has in place to deal with flooding as it happens, if you wanted to look at heat in the state, go to heat risk. You can see, a lot of facilities have, from my reporting, that not every facility in Missouri has air conditioning. You could find out which facilities do and don't, and start to develop sources among advocates, among people, among like basically talk to the admin first and make sure that you're doing that in a way that's safe and appropriate. You know, another way to use the data is if there's a big disaster happening, you know, say you're in California and there's big wildfires, or, you know, the path of a storm or a wildfire, and determine what's in that pathway and start to like make calls and find out who's evacuating and who's not. You can also, again, go on the side and see more about, like, here, this is High Desert State Prison. They have severe wildfire risk. And, you know, the prisons in this area, people in these facilities were really badly impacted over this past fall. So, yeah, I'll leave it there. But I think from here, I would love to open up the conversation. I have deferred to you all as much as possible and hear what questions you have. Yeah, I can start on that one. I mean, we had to think about that a ton with this data, where it's like block by block in a city, clear as possible with that. We had like a, you know, methodology, decide what we felt like was enough information for it to, for the visualization to not be misleading. In this map, we decided to put this facility, all these closed facilities here, which, you know, we still might, we're not, this year alone, many facilities have opened, and how much it mattered. And we kind of landed on this being a snapshot in time. You know, with the flood risk too, we had with many buildings, a single facility, very large, and flood risk varies quite a bit among, like on a single facility. You know, sometimes there's multiple land uses on a single tract of land that include, really want to understand, you know, again, we couldn't provide like every caveat on our visualization, but we made some choices about it. Model does include things like precipitation and sea level rise. They really include a wide range of. One of the big limitations to like the flood data is that it's not going to be predictive of some of the things that cause the most harm during a hurricane, such as like wind. You know, like a lot of these facilities are having problems because like power infrastructure is impacted. And I would love to like do mapping that did a better job of telling that story. Though this map of facilities, which was a little bit hard to work with initially, so that, you know, someone could like look at the path of a hurricane together, that kind of base map, make it easy for reporters to build on. I haven't heard of that happening, but it would be great. And the other part of the question? So I think we have time for one more question. Oh, it's Sophie's choice up here. Yes.
Hi, I'm Whitney.
Yeah, I mean, I have no data background at all. I've like done those data trainings and immediately forgotten all of what I learned. So it was really essential to have a data, to have Akhil working on this with me, and had the baseline of what I would need to make the project happen if I had that data person. So maybe as a freelancer, you could start to, you know, figure out what a data project might look like and connect with other organizations that might have that kind of support. But I do think you need a, like, I don't think, I definitely could have to end there, but we'll stick around for a little while if people have additional questions. And yeah.